Nikki talked nicely about the first resolve yesterday, to be resolved on wisdom. And she spoke nicely about how wisdom is associated in Buddhism with avoiding what's harmful and doing what's beneficial for oneself, for others, and both for self and others. And I'm not sure what the self and others means, like the Buddha meant, but how I like to understand it is that there's a concern for the welfare of ourselves, for sure, concern for the welfare of others, and then it's the we, and I see self and other meaning the community that we create and form together, and it has a different, the we-ness has a different quality. It has a different, we care for we in a different way than we care for you or me. The we-ness has different dynamics that come into play and how you care for it. This kind of pragmatic criteria for wisdom based on what is beneficial, what avoids harm. And this, in some ways, lays at the heart of the Buddha's teachings when we see things like the Four Noble Truths, or his teaching that he says, one place, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. What I teach is suffering and the end of suffering. And there's this concern with suffering and the freedom from it, suffering and peace, that is not exactly a philosophical issue. It's not a metaphysical issue or a cosmological issue, but rather it's an experiential issue. It's something that individuals experience directly for themselves. And that the connection to the Dharma, the connection to wisdom, is in something we can know for ourselves, we can experience for ourselves. And one of the reasons why this wonderful balance between caring for oneself and caring for others, and for both, is that as we benefit ourselves with the highest benefit, then we can understand better what's possible for other people as well. And if we have really managed to mature in a full way, if we've managed to free ourselves from suffering in a full way, if we've managed to develop compassion and love in a full way, experience profound possibilities of a heart that's at peace, deeply at home in itself, then we have a sense, a clear experience of what is the highest good for someone else as well. And then we can support that, we can guide that, we can mirror that, we can speak to that. But if we don't know that, really know it for ourselves, I probably can't try to offer that or support people in that or with a lot of confidence or with a lot of clarity, yes, this is true, this is what's important, this is valuable. And so in this ancient teachings of the Buddha, he says that if he uses an analogy of two people who are stuck in like mud or quicksand, if they're both in it, and one of them tries to pull out the other one, the person who's pulling out the other one, lifting up the other one, just gets pushed down further. And then the other one wants to pull out the other one and help that one. So that's number two tries to lift or pull out, but that gets that person to sink deeper down. So they progressively get deeper and deeper in the mud if they're in the deep mud, to begin with. One of them has to get up on dry ground, and then they can pull the others out. So this, the Buddha, the same thing with when people mature and develop and really have a sense of how to be free themselves, not to be caught in attachments, caught in fear, caught in hate, that then they're in a much better position to be able to pull other people out. If we're standing on dry ground, then we can maybe support and help other people get out of the mud. And so the one way of understanding the ground, dry ground that we can stand on, that offers solid support, is the four resolves. We can be resolved on or base our lives on wisdom, base our lives on truth, base our life on relinquishment and generosity, base our lives on peace. And these are, you know, can be quite, you know, from a spiritual point of view or Buddhist point of view, these are solid ground. Though, you know, you won't be able to point to peace exactly, you know, like you can't touch it in an ordinary way. But these inner qualities are something that's have tremendous value and are reliable and something that can really support us through our lives. And so today is the topic is truth, to base our life on truth, to be resolved on truth. And in some ways this was probably the, you know, there's so many doors that get us to where we are today. You know, it's important steps, but in some ways I grew up as an atheist, a disinterested atheist for the most part. They couldn't care less if I was an atheist. But certainly spirituality, religion was not something that I had any interest in. And so certainly at some point I was surprised to find myself doing what I do. How did this happen? And but one of those things, the turning point that kind of pulled me into this world, got me into this world, was I visited probably the largest hippie community, a commune in America back in the hippie times. And there were about 700-800 hippies living there. Of all places for hippies to be, it was in rural Tennessee, a place that was called The Farm. And they got there from Haight-Ashbury. That's where they all got, they started. They went on a trip in a big caravan of psychedelic buses. And they ended up in Tennessee. They bought this farmland there. And their sacrament was LSD. But it turned out, to their surprise, that it didn't work very well to do a lot of LSD in Tennessee, like the way it did in San Francisco. And in fact, the leader of the group and some of the senior people, when I got there, they were in jail for using something. But so they realized that they couldn't really continue with their sacrament in Tennessee, so they had to come up with an alternative. And the alternative they came up with was honesty. And can you imagine that honesty is as powerful as LSD? That says a lot for one of them. Depending which one you think is most powerful, you can make the equation the other way. And so they came up with honesty. And so when I got there, I wasn't planning to stay, but I'd never been around people who were so honest. And the honesty meant that they talked to each other about conflict in the community. They had a practice of just, if there was tension, they would stop and talk about it. And to be around people who had this commitment to talk about the challenges in the community, and sometimes they would talk, you know, for a few hours until it was all got resolved. And then I was quite inspired by the people who had been doing it for some while and had gotten really good at it, and they could kind of work out challenges really quickly. And sometimes I actually saw it, that there was some ripple. And people would just look at each other, raise an eyebrow, and the other one would smile or nod, yeah, I got it. And they didn't have to, that was because they all knew each other so well from talking about this. So I was quite inspired, so that's why I stayed. And then because I stayed, turned out that the Bible of this community was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And so I read this book, and this book spoke to me so much that I went to San Francisco Zen Center to practice, and that was my beginning of my Buddhist practice. So, you know, honesty hooked me in, the truth. I thought it was so valuable. The Yesterday, Nikki connected the idea of wisdom with benefit. And I was thinking about what is it, what's the connection of peace? What association do I have with that? That might be different than doing what's beneficial for self and others. And I think I associate truth with peace, first and foremost, that what is truth, in a capital T, is what brings peace. Kind of settle something. What is truth brings safety. And so I associate safety with truth, somehow. And truth I also associate with release, with freedom. And you know, there's a saying that truth will set you free. That exists in different cultures. Different religions have similar little phrases. And I think it's a concept that's very close to our practice of insight meditation, mindfulness. I think of mindfulness as a practice of honesty. Honesty is a little bit different than truth. Honesty is acknowledging what is true. It's speaking at least to yourself. This is true about me. This is true. What's going on? To really see the truth. And so, I think that mindfulness is a radical practice of honesty. There is a lot of discussion that goes on in certain philosophy classes and other places about should you always be honest? And should you always speak the truth? And from what I understand about Buddhist practice, Buddhist teachings, one answer to that question is that you should always be honest with yourself. What you do beyond yourself, maybe that gets a little complicated, and when you speak the truth, when you don't, and how you figure that out. That's an endless discussion that people have. But the idea that unequivocally be honest with yourself. Don't lie to yourself. Don't hide from yourself. Really be willing to kind of see yourself in an honest way. And that's not necessarily an easy thing to do, and so there's two powerful ways that I know that this can happen. One is to sit down and start recognizing what's happening in the present moment. And it doesn't require a lot of analysis or investigation or, you know, active thinking about it. Tanisiro Bhikkhu, this monk in Southern California, once told me that if you go to the plains of Africa to be a nature photographer, and you want to get photographs of lots of animals, you don't go kind of racing around the plains looking for all the animals. You set yourself up at a watering hole, and sooner or later all the animals come to the watering hole. I don't know if that's true, but anyway, it's just an analogy. And it comes to the watering hole. So in our practice, we also set ourselves up at the watering hole, and everything has to come. And so the watering hole are two things. You can choose which of these two you would like to sit at. The present moment. If you're really in the present moment, sooner or later, everything you need to know is going to show up. But if you're carefully attentive to the present. If you want to be a little bit more efficient about that, then the watering hole is suffering. If you're really attentive and sensitive to when there's tension, when there's distress, when there's stress, when there's sorrow, lamentation, all the different words that Buddhism subsumes under the word suffering, dukkha. If you just are sensitive to that, everything you need to know for your peace, for your freedom, for your compassion will show itself to you if that's where you sit. You don't have to go looking for anything. You don't have to try to figure it all out. You don't have to get a PhD in Buddhist studies. You just have to kind of sit there, and it'll kind of things will become clearer and clearer as you. That kind of honesty and willingness to sit there with what's uncomfortable or what's since brings you a sense of dis-ease. And that's not meant to that you should go looking for suffering. Because the practice does come with it, a movement towards greater ease and greater peace and happiness, well-being, and that's not to be denied. But if you're sensitive and honest about seeing where when it's not there, even in these small ways that might come up, that's a window into understanding how you operate, what goes on, where are the attachments, where are the resistance, where is the beliefs that are operating, where's this self identity issues that are coming into play that are feeding into the stress that you're feeling. And so to kind of become sensitive to where there's some kind of discomfort and be willing to stop and look at that is a very powerful way of practicing. And as I saw in that beginning for me when I was at the farm in Tennessee, they did it socially. The slightest little tension between them socially, they stopped and looked at it together. And it was inspiring to me to see how, after a while, people had done it for some time, that how efficient it was, how things got clarified right away, and the depth of connection between people that probably was unimaginable to me beforehand, where the idea of meeting and talking about conflict and disagreements and was frightening, or like, that can't go anywhere good, or, you know, that's too much, or, I don't know, you know, am I strong enough to handle this? Well, all kinds of kind of resistances to it. But the people who'd gotten good at it, it was kind of, there was an ease, and kind of, and there wasn't any conflict in dealing with the tension. They all wanted to deal with the tension, because they could see how it led to goodness. So the same thing, you know, in terms of practice, to eagerly be willing to kind of stop and look for where we're uncomfortable, because not so that Buddhists suffer better, that's not what we're trying to do, but rather that we can kind of really look at it honestly, clearly, and see what's deeper. So to be based on the truth, so mindfulness is based on truth and trying to discover what's really the truth. And I think it's an interesting kind of understanding of what truth is how the Greeks understood the truth. Apparently the Greek word for truth is aletheia, I think is how it's pronounced. And aletheia apparently means the state of not being hidden, a state of not being covered over. And so the idea of mindfulness practice is to be able to see and recognize what's there when things aren't covered over anymore, things aren't hidden by ignorance, by distraction, by projections of all kinds that we put on top of things. So to learn how to kind of begin looking behind the veil of concepts, ideas, projections, transferences, all kinds of things that we, biases, prejudices that we have, and be able to kind of see see beyond that so things are no longer hidden. And I think that's also quite a beautiful thing, capacity to start seeing what we've often don't see. Seeing about ourselves what we don't see, that we're so quick, that we don't see if we live in this world of our concepts and ideas, and we kind of automatically or habitually believe all the ideas that we tell ourselves, all the ideas that we internalize from our family, friends, society, without question, they're just there and this is how it is. And it's quite painful how we internalize things, these things. And to give you a simple example, that I don't think it caused me any serious harm. So But how simple it can, how easy it can happen, is in seventh grade, I had an art class, and I was busy. We were supposed to do some drawing of something. I don't know what the assignment was, but I interpreted it to be that I was going to, with my right hand, make a drawing on my left hand. And so I was busy drawing the left hand, and there's a lot of lines in there, so I was putting all the lines in, and I didn't know what I was doing. But the teacher looked over the shoulder and said to me, in the most easygoing, matter-of-fact way, like just, you know, like it's sunny outside, that kind of way, said, oh, you don't have any artistic ability. And I wasn't looking to have any artistic ability. It never occurred to me that I should or wanted to or anything, so the sky is blue, and I don't have no artistic ability. I took that to be the truth. That was the authority figure, and so it must be true. And it wasn't until I went to college that I was tricked into doing art and by my born-again artist roommate. And then, lo and behold, I had some artistic ability. I actually, for a little while, became an art major in college. So one of the functions of mindfulness practice is to be able to be in the present clearly enough so that we begin seeing not only the breathing, not only our body, what goes on, but also begin seeing the thoughts, the ideas, the stories that we overlay on top of ourselves, we overlay on top of our experience. And to see them as an overlay, to see them as thoughts, and then put a little question mark behind them. Some of our ideas and thoughts are accurate enough and should be appreciated and valued, but there's a fair percentage of those thoughts we have, especially ones that give birth to our suffering, which are often based on a variety of errors or a variety of kind of painful ways in which we hold on to them. We cling to them, we grasp onto them, or we're glued to them, and we see the world through the filter of them. Oftentimes it involves imposing projections on other people which are deleterious to them. So, but to see a person and to see a thought arise in the mind, so for example, I see someone and I think that's a dangerous person. But if I don't see it as a thought that arises in the moment, then it's too easy to kind of just think, well, that's who the person is. It's kind of like, just like, you know, just it's true somehow. The perception and the thought get melded together. And the perception and thought become one, and just that's, that person is a dangerous person. But if you're still enough and you watch a thought arise, and you see the thought and the person are distinct, the thought and the perception are distinct, then it's possible then to put a question mark next to the thought, dangerous person. And then, because you have a question mark, then you take a better look. You look at the person and, really? So, well, actually not. I see now, the person just reminds me of the bully in high school. But actually, not that person. So I had this association that was not really valid. But because we saw the separation, the distinction. And so the same thing with ourselves. We have all these ideas and stories that we've internalized about ourselves. And we perceive ourselves. We think about ourselves. We perceive ourselves. We experience ourselves in some way. But the stories, these ideas that we have get entangled with the... with our perception of ourselves, and we don't see it as being distinct. As the mind gets quieter and stiller, as the mind is able to stay in the present moment more, it's possible to watch a thought arise, and then see it as just a thought, and then you know, not, you know, put a question mark next to it. Is this really true? And there's a lot for many people. Some of the most important thoughts that bring us suffering or cause trouble for ourselves in the world are often quite subtle. They're not like the surface thoughts, and so you have to be kind of quiet and still to see them. So for example, what I only saw, I started seeing when I was on retreat, was a number of different thoughts. One was that the grass is always greener somewhere else, meaning that whatever is happening to me, it was better somewhere else, some of the other people. More insidious was the idea that if it's happening to me, it can't be the real thing. Whatever it was, not this, whatever's happening to me, it can't really count. Now that's a recipe for not getting along with yourself. Nothing could be good enough then. Another thing that I noticed after I started sitting these retreats is how pervasive, but also subtle, there was a sense of guilt. That somehow I was guilty. But I didn't have to have a reason to be guilty. So it was a very efficient form of guilt. I just was. But I start seeing these thoughts arise. And I said, oh, look at that. And especially in the context of sitting quietly and peacefully for a few moments, and then seeing the contrast between just being here, minding my own business, breathing quietly, and then this addition came, something was added of these thoughts that floated up. And so then I would say, oh, look at that. And so it took a while to start seeing them. It's a thought. It's an idea. Is it true? Is it the truth? And after a while, it dawned on me, no, this is not the truth. This is like just some kind of, some kind of internal habit that is operating. And then it wasn't easy to just stop doing it. But the fact that I no longer believed it wholeheartedly, kind of subconsciously, made a huge difference. And it began to kind of slowly decrease the intensity of them or the strength of them or the investment that I put into them, the way I fed these by being involved in them. So if truth means to uncover what is covered, the state of no longer being hidden, part of that is to see how we hide, how we cover over, what we put over things. And one of the things that seems quite remarkable to me is I practiced, and this is why I think retreats are kind of special, is so little is needed when we're on retreat. We don't have to do a lot of, social things. We don't have to perform, we have to work. Some of you, you have your little job that you do and have a schedule you follow. It's pretty simple life. That's kind of what it's meant to be. And so it's easier to just breathe, give yourself breathing room, to see if you can just be and start to shed a lot of the complicated ideas and history and conditioning that we have, so we can just start getting a sense of what it's been like to just breathe and be present in a very, very simple way, just to be alive. It's characterized or represented for me in the wonderful teaching that my Zen teacher Mel Weitzman gave me, seemingly just as an aside one day. He asked me how I was, and I told him different things of what was going on with me since I saw him last. And then when I finished saying that, he just said in a casual way, just to be alive is enough. And that was from that moment, the way he said it, or I heard it, that was such a powerful experience for me. At that moment, just to be alive is enough for me was interpreted to be that I'm not guilty, I don't have to prove myself, I don't have to apologize for myself, that there's a dignity and worth as a human being just to be here, breathe as I am. And so to kind of discover that simplicity of being, no apologies for who you are, no shame, no proving yourself, no, just to be here. It's not an easy place to come to. But to begin kind of teasing apart what goes on in our hearts and minds by sitting quietly and starting, just be here, see what's here, see what's here, see what's present. To settle the mind, to be more and more in the present moment. Stop wandering around in the highways and byways of your thoughts and stories and your past and your possible future. But just here, here. Because this is where, in some way in Buddhism, we understand that everything begins anew every moment. There's a kind of amazing newness that's available. And there's a way in which, even though the past, we're a continuation of the past, there's also a way in which everything starts over again, moment by moment. And this is one of the things I learned from the people who took a lot of LSD in Tennessee. I think they called it the insoluble nature of the universe. I have no idea what that means. But how I understood it, what was explained to me, was that this moment will never be here again, and everything is starting fresh every moment. And that became kind of like a question or a koan for me. Really? How does that work? But because I had that question, that interest, it was like, well, you know, what is it about now that everything is, that this now will never be here again? What is it about this now that it's a new beginning? How can that be? What does that look like? How can I make that be? And as I got a sense of how that might be possible, how that might be true, I saw that there was freedom in that understanding. There's a freedom of not holding on to the past. There's freedom of not, of kind of being fresh, having kind of a beginner's mind, to have an open mind, and to see kind of clearly this moment without a lot of the past, you know, carrying along, the conditioning carrying along. And the better we can do that, the better suffering becomes the watering hole, where we can see even deeper and more clearly that their suffering becomes our teacher, both for ourselves but also for our society, as we stop and recognize and able to recognize better the challenges of our society and the suffering that's there. Learn to pay more careful attention to that too. That's an important watering hole as well to sit at and see that. So to uncover the truth. Truth are not facts, though a fact can be true. There's something different about, at least for me, the word truth, because it brings, when we really recognize the truth with a capital T, there's a power to it. And perhaps that's why Mahatma Gandhi talked about the power of truth in his famous expression Satyagraha that he gave, and which then morphed by Martin Luther King into the expression soul power. Seems like the word soul power came from Gandhi, so a translation of it or an adaptation of it. There's a power in truth, and there's a power through the clarity of seeing what's going on, really knowing what's going on. There is power in the confidence that we are being true, if we are true to ourselves, true to, you know, to live a life of truth is a life of hopefully clarity or confidence or, knowing that nothing to hide. One of the things that and I practiced after I left the farm, there were times when I experimented with trying to be an open book. And the idea was, could I go through my day, and if anybody asked anything of me whatsoever, could I be an open book to them? And that became one of my practices, to see if I could do that. What was it like to do that? Could I be truthful to any question anyone brought me? And, you know, that was a challenge, but it was a valuable one, because then again, the places where I was reluctant to do that, I got to look at myself more deeply. So why is that? Why don't I want to say those things? What's holding me back? And I learned that it wasn't necessary to hold myself back as much as I did. I also learned that sometimes it was necessary to hold myself back. And because not everyone treats the knowledge they learn in respectful ways or careful ways. So how to negotiate that and find the way was, you know, part of the learning. Another thing I associate truth with, kind of maybe with capital T, is I associate it with relaxing. I associate it with the heart kind of settling and kind of coming at home, being resting. Like, oh yes, that's how it is. Now I see. And something relaxes, something releases in the process. Truth has the effect of release. You know, our lives are difficult, and we hold ourselves and brace ourselves and try to make things work. And there's something about the power of truth. Oh, okay. So what is that truth that allows us to finally let go? For people who do vipassana, mindfulness practice, there's a lot of emphasis on the truth of impermanence. To really, so there's something about seeing how things arise and pass, the coming and going, especially if you can be, not in the abstract, not like as a concept, but if you can kind of be so much in the, so clearly rooted in the present moment, like that's where the perception abides, where the ability to tune in is really kind of centered here, just what's here, only here, then we start seeing things coming and going, much more acutely, coming and going and coming and going. And there's something about seeing that which the Buddhist tradition holds up as being freeing, as being releasing. If we don't see things arise and pass, we don't see how they're constantly changing in our experience, then it's easier to fall into what's called the delusion of permanence. And if we think things are constant or permanent in any kind of way, then it's easier to kind of be stuck on that. And if you're stuck on it, it's easier to be stuck on your suffering. But if you actually see how everything is arising and passing, it's harder to get stuck, because you can't get stuck on something which is dissolving and disappearing. You know, just, you know, and something that arises and comes and goes. So that the truth of impermanence, to be here and see that. There's also the most famous notion of truth in Buddhism is the Four Noble Truths. And here, these truth in this sense is not is not meant to be a religious belief or tenet. Some Buddhist scholars have pointed out that the word satya, which is a Pali word for truth, maybe should be better translated as a reality, or what's real. So the Four Noble Truths are kind of the four realities, in the sense that we can experience them. So it's not to believe them, we're here to experience them. And so the first truth is the truth of suffering. The second truth is often presented as the truth of the craving that gives birth to suffering. So it's possible to experience suffering directly. So it's kind of a reality. It's real enough. And it's possible to experience for oneself the role that craving has, clinging, holding on. In fact, you can't cling without suffering. Kind of the rewording of the Four Noble Truths is, if you cling, you will suffer. If you let go of that clinging, the suffering will end. And so then there's a truth, the reality of that suffering ending, the clinging ending, the suffering ending. And then there's the role that the Eightfold Path has, a path of practice that supports us and guides us to that possibility. We realize I can't do this easily, but I can do a practice that leads me to this possibility of freedom, of release. So it's kind of powerful that this tradition here that we're in holds up in a certain kind of esteem or a certain kind of, esteem maybe, the experience of suffering. Not to suffer better. they even add the title noble to it, or the noble truth of suffering. That there's something powerful about connecting to what's really here. And part of practice is finding out how to relate to any experience we have so that we're free in relationship to it. We don't get burdened by it or get tripped up by it. So what is it like to experience suffering without resistance, without running away, without attacking and blame and anger? What's it like to experience our immediacy of our suffering sitting here without trying to fix it in some complicated way? What's it like to be able to experience it with equanimity, with a certain kind of calm and peace, without agitation? Just experience it as the truth. Oh, I'm suffering. That's what's happening. The truth, oh, this is true. I'm not comfortable, I'm stressed, I'm afraid. There's something very helpful to find a way to suffer that is simple suffering. That is just the suffering in itself without all the added additions of reactivity that we have on top of it. Now, maybe we shouldn't have advertised this retreat, come and experience simple suffering. I don't know if you would have come, but I think that I found it for myself very satisfying, or I'd say it better, I think. There are times when I felt that this is really right. There's a rightness to it. To allow myself to experience my suffering in its simplicity. And sometimes I've been around other people who are suffering, and I'm trying to help them. I want it to be different, for sure, for them. But there's a rightness in being present for that suffering. If it's happening, to be present for it. There's something about the simplicity and the rightness of just being with it in its direct way. The truth of suffering. And then there's a truth of seeing the clinging, the craving, the reactivity that we have. And I love this idea of seeing the truth, seeing it as the truth. Oh, this is what's happening. Because for me, the word truth here in this context means we're not adding judgments and shame and self-criticism on top of it. Here I'm seeing I'm clinging, my resistance, my grasping, my attachment. It just, the truth of it means to let that be really simple. Simple clinging. And then learn the simplicity of attention so that, we don't see the clinging we have and say, well, I guess I'm a bad Buddhist. I shouldn't be clinging. I better not hang out with the Buddhists. They'll bust me, or all kinds of things, make it so complicated. But just to see the truth of clinging, look at that. There's clinging, of course. And then to see the truth of the absence of it, when it's not there, the cessation, the ending of it. I think many people are so busy in their minds with thinking and doing and wanting, that they don't notice the moments when certain maybe small sufferings disappear, because then they're on to the next thing to suffer about. There's a lot of good things to suffer about. You know, there's a lot, there's a long list. But it's actually very good to take time to see the truth of cessation, the truth of it. Ah, look at that. Yesterday I was struggling, and today I'm not. Look, that's true. And then the truth of having a practice. And for me, this is like the best truth of them all. The fact that we have these wonderful practices of certainly mindfulness, of concentration, of ethical practices, of right intention, right view. I just feel so fortunate that I can engage in this process of clarification, this process of purification, this process of seeing deeply, this process of becoming free. And sometimes I don't feel it's that important how far I get on this path, because I'm just so happy to be on the path. You know, take the next step. Take the next step. That just seems like it's enough for this lifetime to just be on the path and go as far as we can go. So the truth, or as some scholars now say, the four realities, the four noble truths, the four noble realities that we can experientially see and experience for ourselves. And then in this little discourse that Nikki and I are pulling the four resolves from, it says that what is ultimate truth, what's really true, and is of no deceptive nature, is not deceptive whatsoever, it's not false, is release, vimoksha, or nibbana. And there's something about the action, the activity of having clung, and then the releasing of the clinging. The opening of the hand in the heart. That release, the experience of release is reliable. The experience of freedom that comes is solid ground that you can stand on. You can base your life on that. That's reliable. And it's for the Buddha, the release is the truth. It's not a thing, and it's not a thing that you can cling to, because like if you open your hand and you like it so much that you want to cling to it, and so you grasp it, you don't have the open hand anymore. You can't grasp at the open hand and still have an open hand. So to release our clinging, to release our heart from its deepest contractions that it has, that experience of release is a place to stand. It's a place to abide in. It's a place to be supported by, but it's not something to cling to. It's not something to define ourselves by. It's not a badge we can wear. It's just this movement, this action, this ongoing experience of opening up, this ongoing experience of freeing, this ongoing experience of putting our burdens down, this ongoing experience of releasing, unbinding ourselves, this ongoing experience of untying the knots that we get knotted up in, ongoing experience of disentangling, ongoing experience of unwinding. I don't know all the possible, probably a lot of words we can use for this, but this ongoing is that there. That's good. And that also can be something that we can experience and find here. And as, if we sit at the watering hole of suffering, maybe, you know, everything that we need to know comes, what we'll find is that over time, the reference point for our lives will no longer be suffering. The reference point for our lives will be peace and freedom. And that becomes more and more the guide. And that becomes the watering hole. And everything you continue need to learn will come visit you if you sit at the watering hole of freedom, of peace. But you need to get there. And yes, to get there in a reliable way, in a way that comes with a lot of understanding. And the best way, this Buddhist tradition, that early Buddhist tradition that I based my teachings on, the other definition of wisdom, besides the one that Nikki talked about yesterday, is to be wise about how you're unwise. I guess you did refer to that. But to really begin to understand it, to understand well how you get caught, to understand well how you get attached, how you get complicated, how you project on things, to understand well what you're actually doing because you see it well. When you really understand those, then you're wise, and then you have a healthy or a realistic way of using freedom and profound heartfelt peace as the watering hole, as the reference point for what to guide you, to support you and your community around you, so that you know for yourself, or you have a sense from your own experience, the depth of peace, the depth of love, the depth of compassion, the depth of freedom that other hearts are capable of. And it'll break your heart to know how far away people are from that. But then the practice is to be a wise person who's concerned with the benefit for oneself, the benefit for others, and the benefit for our community as a whole. So truth. Wisdom and truth. To be resolved, committed, dedicated on these beautiful qualities as we follow the path of our practice. Sometimes it's a custom on these talks at the end to kind of reestablish ourselves in the meditation posture, to make a nice transition from listening to returning into more the less listening mode and more the mindfulness mode.